Planning on traveling this summer? Make saving at the pump part of your plans with 2x the fuel points from Harris Teeter. It's easy. Download your eVic coupon, and for every dollar you spend with your Vic card, you'll get 2 fuel points. That's up to $1 per gallon on quality fuel at participating BP and Harris Teeter fuel centers. Download your eVic coupon today and save money at the pump all summer long with eVic and Harris Teeter fuel points.
Thank you for downloading Tucker Center Talks. This is Season 3, Episode 16. You're listening to Tucker Center Talks, a podcast from the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota and a co-production with WISP Sports. I'm your host for Tucker Center Talks, Dr. Nicole Lavoy, Director of the Tucker Center. Tucker Center Talks is a place where I talk to, amplify, and support my female colleagues, amazing women who study sport and gender. We try to let data tell the story, and we talk about our research and ways that we use the data to change the world through the context of sport to be a better place. In this podcast, we have a return guest from Season 2, Episode 11, in June of 2020, where I first talked to my colleague and Tucker Center-affiliated scholar, Dr. Dunja Antunovic. Welcome back to Tucker Center Talks.
Thank you for having me, Dr. Lavoy. It's great to be back on the podcast.
Yeah, we're going to talk about some of your more recent work since we last spoke. And before we do that, I'm going to ask you, this is a new feature of Tucker Center Talk starting today, because I get to talk to scholars and researchers such as yourself. And I'm curious, when I ask you, what does doing research mean to you? How would you briefly describe that?
So I actually, when I talk to students, I tell them that my dissertation was on reading the Chicago Tribune. But essentially, some of my work involves reading media, watching media, listening to media. And of course, as a part of my dissertation, and also as a part of some of my later work and current work, it also entails talking to professionals and people who work in the industry. And then depending on the project, doing research might also entail distributing surveys and collecting data in that way.
Okay. Well, I have recently discovered, and maybe this is just my own ignorance, or maybe my own vision, my own myopic vision, is that my thinking about what doing research means, it is not the same as other people's. And I think maybe perhaps we all have a different, slightly different idea of what that means. So I think when we are exploring research on this podcast, then I think it's important to sort of start with the premise of what does that mean to you and me and for our discussion. So thanks for that. Okay, let's dig into some recent chapters that you've written. Namely, let's start with the chapter you wrote about social media platforms and sponsors, cultural narratives around women's sport, which is a chapter about American women's football in the new book titled, which will be in the show notes, The Professionalization of Women's Sport. So tell us about this chapter and what are the kind of the key highlights?
Thank you for asking about this. And I'm really happy that I have the opportunity to talk about, we will talk about two chapters today. One of which is in the book that you mentioned on professionalization, edited by Dr. Ali Bose and Dr. Alex Colvin. This book really was formed with this idea and purpose to identify the varying processes in the professionalization of women's sports. We know based on our colleague, Dr. Nancy Lowe's research, of course, that women's sport is on the rise. There's a growth in terms of viewership numbers, investment, fandom. We also have industry data from Nielsen, from Deloitte to support this, and from the Sports Innovation Lab, right? So I think those of us who are working on research on women's sport, we are noticing these patterns. And this book, I think it's really interesting because it sort of starts with this premise that the professionalization process in women's sport is distinct from the professionalization process of men's sport because of the historical and sociocultural factors. And so just so we are on the same page, I want to share with the listeners this quote from the introduction that the editors wrote of what we actually mean by professionalization. And so they describe this process as, quote, the process of professionalization underpinned by progressive gender ideologies involves women's sports organizations demonstrating an increasing formalization of their administration and structure through policy and practice, resulting in the formal contracting of women as athletes for financial remuneration. So there's a lot happening in this definition, but essentially what I think the book really observes is that often this process is really more of a semi-professionalization process, right? That athletes are sometimes getting paid, sometimes they're not, sometimes they have healthcare, sometimes they don't, sometimes they work other jobs, sometimes they don't, right? So it's very uneven. It's very diverse in terms of sport and geographic region. And so when I saw this call for chapters, I was really interested in sort of perhaps exploring a context that we don't often know much about or hear much about in the context of the U.S. And so here I want to give credit to my colleagues and collaborators that I've worked with on previous projects, Dr. Andy Linden from Cal State Northridge and Dr. Katie Taylor, who is at De Montfort University. And they are historians of women's sport or sport in general, and they're historians of women's American football in particular. And so our previous projects focused on the history of media representations of women's football. And this call for chapters was a really good opportunity for us to bring that analysis into a more contemporary setting.
Yeah. And so for the listeners who might be thinking women in American football, I've found that a lot of people are not aware that we have a professional women's football league. Football is an American football, not soccer. And we have a team right here in Minneapolis who played for the national championship. And so tell us a little bit about what you wrote about in that chapter around media visibilities for women in American football.
Yes. So first, yes, thank you for providing that context. And I think one key, component of especially Dr. Taylor's work and dissertation work and some of the journal articles and chapters that she's working on is that women have been playing American football for a really long time. And there were all these sort of processes and barriers and emergence of leagues and then, folding of leagues that have been happening. So it's not a new phenomenon. But one of the interesting aspects that was happening as we started analyzing the data was that after we sort of submitted this chapter proposal, there was a significant shift that happened in terms of the design and graphics on the website and some of the news stories about sponsorships, which we really didn't anticipate. So, it was happening as we were writing. And one of the co-authors on this project is my former student, Mac Watt, who sort of approached this from a media production perspective, right? And so we were looking at sort of design of the website. We were looking at broadcast quality, right? We were trying to figure out how many cameras are there on the field in terms of broadcast, because we know that these aspects influence viewers' perceptions. So we use this term mediated visibilities, rather than media coverage, because we wanted to move away from specifically focusing on how journalists are covering women's American football. We explore that in our other project. And here we wanted to take into account the complex ways in which different content producers bring visibility to women's American football. So part of it was, you know, looking at the website and sort of the announcements about sponsorships, right? And what we noticed was this, a lot of the quotes and statements were really about not just generally sort of establishing a partnership, but also supporting gender equality, right? And supporting women's participation in sport. We also did look at some news articles about the league that were posted on social media and about specific teams, like local media coverage about some of the teams. And also, this was the time when Katie Sowers was very visible because of the Super Bowl. And so there was definitely a lot of connection in some of the media coverage between Sowers' participation and then sort of career path, right? So there was a lot of different
For what listeners that don't know, she was a fairly well-known player in the league and then went on to coach at the professional level in the NFL for the Chiefs. What team was she on? I should know that. Let's look it up.
I think the 49ers.
The 49ers. I was thinking, I knew the logo had red in it. And she is really an important figure.
And then before joining the Chiefs, yes.
Yeah. Okay, good. All right. I was right. Great. So what, you know, as a listener and someone who would like to read the chapter, wants to read the chapter, what are sort of the big, what's a big take home out of this data and what we learn?
So some of the aspects that we're learning is that, I think that a lot of the conversations were sort of mirroring the larger narratives that we've been hearing about women's sports in terms of sponsorships, right? And particular sponsors who are using this message of gender equality, right, to support women's professional sports or semi-professional, or however we might call the phases that some of these leagues are in. I think we also noticed that there is sort of this in the news media coverage, there is still this novelty value, right? That and my colleague, Dr. Taylor, talks a little bit about this as well, right? From a historical perspective, that, you know, there is this element of women's American football is something new. I think the other aspect is that, often women's sports have had to, and this is true for historically and also in the present, have to sort of rely on their own platforms in order to promote their own league and teams. And they're because of general lack of media coverage that happens in this space. So these are some key takeaways. And I think, obviously there are very specific aspects about where this league was at the time, but some of the larger cultural narratives that were present in these visibilities were also evident, I think, in broader narratives about women's sports.
Yeah, I was really struck in 2021. There was the 2020 just in like, didn't even happen almost because it seemed like we were all in our own COVID bubble. But for the Tucker Center Film Festival, we featured a film called Born to Play, which was a documentary about the Boston Renegades team, which is very well known and multiple national champions in the Women's Football Alliance. And I got to know some of the players and we did a panel after. And the one thing that struck me precisely is what you're talking about is how they have to promote themselves. And even the documentary, which was filmed on one camera, and oftentimes they'd scan the field and there would be no other media present. And so I think it's interesting to see the scholarly critique of this alongside the real experiences of the athletes in the league with this documentary. And I'll put the link to that film in the show notes. It's a really good watch.
Great.
Well, yeah, well, let's talk about your other body of work and chapter that you've been working on recently. How might media coverage, I mean, a lot of the research that I know of and that typically is out there is around media coverage of female athletes in the U.S. And I know there is data in other cultural contexts. So what do you want to tell us about that?
Well, there are a few aspects to mention here, and I think the professionalization of women's sports edited collection is actually sort of a good entry point into that conversation as well. And I know Dr. Lavoie, you will also share the maybe the book launch YouTube panel with the listeners for this book in particular, because it addresses how this professionalization process and also media coverage varies depending on the cultural and geographic context. And so what we know is really, of course, that sport is structured very differently depending on the country, depending on, you know, where the funding comes from for sport, depending on the structure of media, depending on which sports have a historical success, right? So all of these factors matter in terms of media coverage. And so one aspect that Dr. Tony Bruce writes about, who wrote this sort of an article that really synthesizes a lot of patterns in media coverage called New Rules for New Times, that article really points to remarkable consistency across contexts in terms of general patterns of gendered media coverage, in terms of percentage of women's sports and so forth. But the reasons for that coverage might vary, right? There might be different reasons why that is. And so one of the areas of research that I'm interested in, and I think this lens is probably also apparent when I do research on the US, right, that I do have a little bit of a comparative lens, as we would call it. Mm-hmm. So one area of my research focuses on the Central and Eastern European context, very broadly. That's a very broad region, and there's sort of pockets of that I focus on.
Yeah.
When I saw sort of the conversation around the 2019 FIFA Women's World Cup, of course, you know, the U.S. media focused a lot on that coverage. And as Dr. Cheryl Cookie's new article, longitudinal study on titled One and Done, right? That's the new the title of the new study. Indicates is that women's sports continue to be underrepresented on ESPN and local television networks. But during the FIFA World Cup, you know, women receive more coverage. And of course, we know that during mega events, women do receive more coverage because they represent the national team. And so, of course, with women's soccer, we know that Canada and the US are dedicating a lot of attention to the tournament. I was curious, what happens when you try to watch the tournament outside of that context, and specifically in a region where the national teams did not qualify, right? Because that sort of national interest component is then potentially missing.
Right. And are people, and do they show it, and are people interested?
Exactly.
And so what did you find?
What I found was that, what is considered sort of public service media, right? Those are media organizations that, I mean, again, they're structured very differently depending on the context. And there are, scholars have been talking about some limitations and issues in related to media structures in the region. But one of the aspects about public service media is that often some of the international events were broadcast on those networks. Currently that occurs as a part of the sort of larger context of European Broadcasting Union feeds that are available, right, in terms of media coverage of international events. Broadcast rights contracts are changing. There is more and more sort of privatization component in terms of these events. And so a lot of, I think Eurosport is broadcasting a lot of these events now and has the rights to these international events. So maybe some of these access components are going to change. But with the 2019 FIFA World Cup, you know, one thing that was notable is that the games did air to some extent in for example Hungary and Serbia. We talk about methodology, right? And one of the aspects about this book that was edited by Dr. Molly Yannity and Dr. Daniel Coombs was that they really gave the researchers a little bit of flexibility in terms of how we want to approach the writing of this piece. And so I was able to sort of write in a little bit more of a reflexive way, right? So I didn't actually count, you know, the number of games and all that, but there were some aspects that I noticed. One, that some games, especially the sort of major games, were available. When I tuned in, the broadcasters seemed to be knowledgeable about the events that were happening and the teams, and provided some, you know, information about, you know, the professional leagues in those in some of the countries, and maybe this was particular to, you know, countries in Europe and of course the US.
The dark web can be like a restaurant for identity thieves.
Hi, ready to order?
I'll have the driver's license number.
Great, that comes with a home address or a birth date.
Ooh, both, please.
It can be dangerously easy to steal your identity. LifeLock by Norton makes it easy to help protect yourself. If you become a victim, we'll work to fix it. No one can monitor all transactions, but everyone can save up to 25% off their first year at LifeLock.com/aware. Identity theft protection starts here.
You were collecting data in a reflexive way. You weren't counting like minutes on TV, but were you in the country, or were you able to go back through like and find recordings of them? Okay.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. I was there. I was there. And so, you know, in some cases, you know, the matches weren't airing live. So definitely there wasn't a continuity. But again, considering that the teams were not participating, the national teams were not participating in the tournament, there still was a little bit of coverage. In some cases, you know, other sporting events had priority where national athletes or national teams participated. For example, Wimbledon was going on at the time. And so there was a, I think, one instance where some of the matches were delayed because Wimbledon was going on. And of course, Dr. Lavoie, you and I are tennis players. And so I think from a broadcasting perspective, I'm not sure how much sense it would have made to actually stop the broadcast in the middle of the match, right? But we definitely sort of still see some patterns in terms of what are the priorities in this very saturated sports media environment. And so it was, you know, from sort of an intellectual exercise, you know, this question of how is, what does women's sports coverage look like of international events where the team, when the team is not, you know, included in the tournament, I think there is a lot more opportunities for us to examine that.
And I know that we both were aware that the EBU, that you mentioned them earlier, the European Broadcasting Union, which would sort of be parallel to what here in the U.S.?
Well, I'm not sure if there is really a parallel, but they're essentially an alliance of public service media organizations.
So it would be like an alliance of PBS Channel 2 sort of networks. Okay, interesting. So they came out with a report recently within the last year or so. How is that report sort of related to some of the work that you're doing?
The report really sort of outlines some recommendations for gender balanced media coverage that I think are, you know, might be generally applicable to media organizations in terms of not just quantity of media coverage, but also the way in which women's sports are represented. There are some recommendations in terms of taking account audiences, right, and ways to reach audiences. Of course, Dr. Lavoie, you were quoted in there in the report as well. And so a lot of the recommendations are really based on research. The report is also making a case that there is a business imperative for covering women's sports, paying attention to sort of the digitalization process. I mean, there is a lot of complex factors that I think are both opportunities and challenges, but the report tries to sort of identify some opportunities and that are specific to that context, but in some cases, I think might be applicable to other areas as well.
Well, it sounds like you have a lot of irons in the fire and that you are working on a lot of really good stuff that is broadening and deepening and globalizing our fans that are listening. I forgot to unplug my phone and nobody ever calls me on my actual office phone anymore, of course, except when I'm trying to do a podcast. So apologies for that. But, you know, whether it's a child in the background or a barking dog or a ringing phone when we're on Zoom, it's always something. So I want to just draw attention to the fact that you're doing really good work to broaden and deepen and globalize the media work of the Tucker Center. So what can we expect coming up? What are you working on that's in the pipeline that's, to be announced in 2022?
Yeah, so I will leave with a question. I think in my last podcast episode, I also sort of omitted to answer a question and really posed a question instead. One of my big questions right now is this, what does gender equality in sports media coverage look like? And we can we can also conceptualize it as what is gender equity in media coverage, or as the EBU report says, what is gender balance? Right. And especially when it comes to sort of international events, some of the scholars who do very good statistical analysis, have sort of did this calculation of percentage of coverage in relation to medal counts or in relation to the number of matches played, or Dr. Roxanne Kosh's work is really remarkable in this area. And of course, Dr. Andy Billings' work on the Olympics. So for me, one of the questions that I'm asking is, what is gender equality look like in media coverage? Does that mean a certain percentage? Does it mean a particular type of representation strategy? And what are the factors that shape that? So along these lines, one of the projects that I'm working on is actually examining those narratives on media coverage. And I think we mentioned this before, and maybe Dr. Cookie also mentioned it in her podcast episode that we're working on a book. So stay tuned. That's going to be coming out in a couple of months. So hope to be able to share that research with the listeners as well.
Yes, I think we will have you both on and you can talk about your book and we'll give it some press. It's much awaited. I know I'm very excited to see this. I know you two have been working hard on that book and I think it will be a great contribution. Okay, we're going to finish up with a speed round. Are you ready?
I think so.
Okay. All right. Your favorite female badass right now in any context, someone who's really kicking butt.
I think I will say I'm very impressed with Dr. Holly Thorpe's research. I feel like every week or every day I'm seeing new updates about the research. So I'm really looking forward to sitting down and actually reading some of that work.
Agree. And I just saw today, and I sent you this in your email, her new book with Lindsay Hayhurst and Megan Chawansky around kind of feminist approaches to sport development. And they always do such good work. So I agree with that. Okay. How about if you are reading anything besides stuff for work, if you're reading a book, either fiction or nonfiction, what is it? And if you're not, that's okay, because I know you are deep in the weeds.
I'll need to get back to you on this. Right now, I'm really just honestly reading for work. So I need to, that should be one of my goals for the next year, to read outside of that.
Okay, so I'll give you one, because I'm obsessed with Brené Brown's podcast right now, and she's just interviewing James Clear, a two-part podcast on atomic habits. And so this is related to what you just said, is that if we want to form a new habit, it's not about goals, like, oh, I want to read more for leisure. That, you know, what does that mean? It's that you actually have to do it. So you have to do like 5 minutes a day. I'm going to read a book or something that's not for work. And it's really interesting, because, you know, as a sports psychologist, we're always talking about goal setting and SMART goals, and it has to be measurable. And he's sort of throwing that out the window. So atomic habits, it's a quite an interesting idea. Okay, last question. And maybe you already answered this, but well, actually, I'm going to mix it up, because the last question was your favorite influential female scholar, which you mentioned Holly Thorpe. So I'll give you a 2-for-1 on that. But what is the sport for the Winter Olympics you're most looking forward to watching?
I think might be curling. Yes, but I'm really looking forward to just tuning in a little bit more into Paralympic news. Some of my projects are focusing on the Paralympics. I think that we can talk about that some other time when the article is actually published. So I want to, pay a particular attention to Paralympic sports in the upcoming months.
Great. Well, I think now that we can see them a little bit more than we have been able to see them on mainstream television, and you certainly can tune in streaming. So I think that would be something I challenge all of our listeners to do, is to support the Olympics and the Paralympics equally, because they're all amazing athletes. Well, Dr. Antunovich, thank you for joining the Tugger Center Talks podcast again for your second episode, and we'll be back to talk to you more in the future on the good work that you're doing.
Thank you very much.
So be sure to check out our many free evidence-based resources on our website at tuckercenter.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. You can find the show notes with all the links of the books and articles and films we talked about in this episode at wispsports.com. Look for the Tugger Center Talks tab, where you'll find more conversations from the world of women's sport. Thank you for listening and helping us turn up the volume on women's sport. That is a wrap for Tugger Center Talks. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Lavoie. I'm going to leave you with a thought. Give yourself grace, support others, and let the data tell the story. That's it. We're signing off from the Tugger Center to make a difference in the lives of girls and women in sport.